Good evening.
Go ahead and turn to Exodus chapter 19. Exodus 19. I'll be reading from there in just a moment.
After the children of Israel had left Egypt, they came to Mount Sinai, and it was here that God told them that they were to be a special people. And in Exodus 19, we'll pick up in verse 1. It says, "In the third month, after the sons of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on that very day they came into the wilderness of Sinai. And when they set out from Rephidim, they came to the wilderness of Sinai and camped in the wilderness. And there Israel camped in front of the mountain. Moses went up to God, and the Lord came to him from the mountain, saying, 'Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the sons of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the sons of Israel.'" Let's see if I can... There we go. So, God told them that they were to be his chosen people. And the next 10 chapters or so of Exodus spelled out how they would worship him, their special laws, their customs, the things that made them different from the people and the other nations around them. The rest of the Pentateuch reinforces that theme, expands on those laws. It talks about the festivals and feasts that they would keep, what they would eat, what they could touch, the clothes they would wear, who they would marry. Talked about the tabernacle, their place of worship and a place of God's own dwelling. And it even talked about how they were governed. Israel was holy or set apart to God. And they were called to be different than all the nations around them. God called them to reverence him and the law that he had given them, to remind them of that they were a special people. And yet, before long, they wanted to be like everyone else. They forgot the laws. They wanted to worship the same idols. They wanted to marry the other nations. Even their form of government, with Saul as their king, they rejected God's judges. They rejected God's kingship over them. They tried to forget that they were special, and they lost their reverence of God and his law. Over and over, they profaned his temple. They profaned his worship. They rejected his law. They rejected him. To the point where in Malachi, God said, "I wish you would just close the doors to the temple and leave me alone." Because they had rejected him completely. They were called to be a special people, to be set apart to God. And yet, they had lost that sense of purpose, that sense of the holy, and replaced it with profanity and sacrilege. As Christians, we too are called to that same holy, to be a holy people. Let's look in 1 Peter chapter 2. In 1 Peter chapter 2, in verse 9, 1 Peter 2, verse 9, Peter writes, "But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim your excellencies of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. For you once were not a people, but now you are the people of God. You had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy." In Romans 10, Paul talks about how we as Christians are grafted into Israel, how we have become part of that spiritual, that continuation of that chosen people. And we're called to holiness, just like Israel was. If you'll flip back a page to 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 14, he says, "As obedient children, do not be conformed to the former lusts which were yours in your ignorance, but like the Holy One who called you, be holy yourselves also in all your behavior. Because it is written, 'You shall be holy, for I am holy.'" But with the influence of everything around us, I think we often struggle like Israel, and we slide into that sameness with those around us, and we lose that sense of holiness. So I want to talk tonight about being holy in an unholy world. I want to look at what that looks like and how we can avoid some of the problems that Israel struggled with. First, I think we need to define holiness. I think everybody, if I asked everybody to raise your hand if you knew what holiness meant, everybody would raise their hand. It's a little harder to put into words, though, sometimes. Fundamentally, holiness means special, different, set apart. an example is the furnishings of the temple and the tabernacle before that were set apart. They were sanctified for the worship and service of God. You didn't use the bronze laver for taking a bath. You didn't use the table of showbread for eating a common meal. As Belshazzar, son of Nebuchadnezzar, found out, you didn't use the cups and the plates for a feast. And that's why he lost his kingship, was because he had disrespected God and his things. At the dedication of the temple, these items were sprinkled with the blood of rams and bulls and were made holy. They were set aside and dedicated to God. In the same way, we've been sanctified by Christ's blood. Let's look in Hebrews chapter 9. In Hebrews chapter 9, verse 11, the Hebrew writer says, "But when Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things to come, he entered through the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, not of this creation, and not through the blood of goats and calves, but through his own blood he entered the holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. For if the blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of a heifer sprinkling those who have been defiled sanctify for the cleansing of the flesh, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God?" Just like the Israelites were set aside through their law and through the covenant with God, we have been set aside and sanctified by Christ's blood. So we've been set apart to serve and to worship God. But I want to change gears a little bit, and I want to talk about God's holiness. God is described as holy. And look at Isaiah chapter 6. Isaiah describes a vision or encounter in the throne room. Isaiah chapter 6. It's a powerful scene. In verse 1, Isaiah writes, "In the year of King Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, lofty and exalted, with the train of his robe filling the temple. Seraphim stood above him, each having six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called out to another and said, 'Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory.' And the foundations of the thresholds trembled at the voice of him who called out, while the temple was filling with smoke. And I said, 'Woe is me, for I am ruined, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts.' Then one of the seraphim flew to me with a burning coal in his hand, which he had taken from the altar with tongs. He touched my mouth with it and said, 'Behold, this has touched your lips, and your iniquity is taken away, and your sin is forgiven.'" God is holy. But really, the only way that God is set apart is that he's so much superior to everything else that he's just in a class by himself. In 1 Samuel chapter 2, Hannah wrote, Hannah prayed after she'd been blessed with Samuel. In 1 Samuel chapter 2, in verse 2, she said, "There's no one holy like the Lord. Indeed, there's no one besides you, nor is there any rock like our God." God is a class by himself. God is the definition of holiness because he's unique. His attributes define holiness for us and are our example of what we're called to be. You know, we look at Isaiah 59, verse 2, says God cannot look at sin. He can't tolerate sin. Titus chapter 1 says God cannot lie. James chapter 1 says he can't even be tempted to sin. And we look at, those are kind of the negative attributes, if you will, the things that he can't do because he's holy, but his love, his mercy, his justice, his righteousness, all of those are perfected in God. All of those are his holiness. And this is the standard that we as Christians are called to. What did Peter say? "Be holy, for I am holy." We are called to that same standard of perfection that God has. And that same standard of holiness. But then we look at ourselves. And we look at David in, after his sin with Bathsheba, and he was confronted by the prophet Nathan. In Psalms 51, David wrote, "For I know my transgression, my sin is ever before me. Against you, you only I have sinned, and done what is evil in your sight, so that you are justified when you speak, and you are blameless when you judge." David recognized that he had no way to stand in God's sight. He was desperate. He had He was a sinner and he needed God's mercy only. Isaiah's reaction in the throne room: woe is me, I am ruined, for I have seen the Lord of hosts. We look at Peter when he met Jesus in Luke chapter 1. In Luke chapter 1, sorry, Luke chapter 5. I think it's Luke chapter 5. Hold on here. Yeah, Luke chapter 5, starting in verse 1. Now it happened while the crowd was pressing around him and listening to the word of God, he was standing by the lake of Gennesaret, and he saw two boats lying at the edge of the lake, but the fishermen had gotten out of them and were washing their nets. And he got into one of the boats, which was Simon's, and asked him to put out a little way from the land. And he sat down and began teaching the people from the boat. And when he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, put out into the deep water and let down your nets for a catch. Simon answered and said, Master, we worked hard all night and caught nothing, but I will do as you say and let down the nets. And when they had done this, they enclosed a great quantity of fish, and their nets began to break. So they signaled to their partners in the other boat for them to come and help them. And they came and filled both of the boats so that they began to sink. But when Simon Peter saw that, he fell down at Jesus' feet, saying, go away from me, Lord, for I am a sinful man, O Lord. The universal reaction for all of these people was one of reverence and one of inadequacy, a recognition that sinful man was vastly inferior to God's holiness. So how do we bridge that gap? How do we bridge that gap between God's holiness and our sin? How do we cultivate holiness? I want to cover quickly three basic things. I think one, we need to realize that we've been separated from others, that we've been called to be a special people. We've been sanctified. In John chapter 17, Christ, before he was betrayed, on the night he was betrayed, when he was praying in the garden, he prayed in verse 14, John 17, 14, I have given them to your word. I have given them your word, and the world has hated them, because they are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. I do not ask you to take them out of the world, but to keep them from the evil one. They are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. Sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth. You know, we are in the world. We are physical beings in a physical world. We are surrounded by people that are not sanctified, not set apart to God's service. But we are not of the world. We are in the world, but we are not of the world. We are called to be something different. We are called to be something else, something more. And this calling, this sanctification, should cause a change in our focus. If you look at Colossians chapter 3, in Colossians chapter 3 and verse 1, Paul writes, therefore, if you have been raised up with Christ, keep seeking the things above where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on the things above, not on the things that are on the earth. And we could go on reading the rest of that chapter because it's a fantastic chapter on practical application of how do you do that. But tonight, for real quick, I just want to focus on our focus. I want to focus on the fact that we need to change our focus. We need to change where we're looking. We need to stop worrying about the temporal and the physical around us and realize that we are heavenly creatures and should have a heavenly focus. I'm reminded of Abraham in Hebrews chapter 11. In Hebrews 11, the Hebrew writer writes in verse 8, by faith Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place which he was to receive for an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith he lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise. For he was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. And down in verse 13 and 14, it talks about how they were seeking a heavenly country. Abraham didn't go to the land of Canaan because he wanted the land of Canaan. Abraham went to the land of Canaan because God told him to. And his focus was not on the physical and the here and now. His focus was on the heavenly. And that's what we need to focus on as Christians who are called out to holiness. And that focus should transform us. If we flip over to Romans chapter 12, verses I'm sure everyone's familiar with, In verses 1 and 2, Paul writes to the Romans, "Therefore I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect." When we focus on the eternal and the heavenly over the physical and the temporal, that should transform our mindset. That should transform our conduct. You know, the example I heard on these verses is that of a thermometer and a thermostat. You know, a thermometer is in a room and it adjusts to the temperature. It's like the Israelites. I want to be like everything around me. A thermostat goes in a room and it sees what the temperature is. It knows what the temperature is supposed to be and it changes that. We as Christians are called to transform our circumstances, not adjust to our circumstances, not change to the same circumstances as those around us, but to transform them and control our circumstances based on the will of God. So what does this look like? What's the practical application here? I want to look at three categories or whatever of what's the practical application of pursuing holiness. First one I want to look at is relationships. I'm sure some of you have heard the quote, "In 5 years, you'll be the same person you are today, with the exception of the books you read and the people you meet." If you've ever been a teenager or had teenagers, you've heard, "Show me your friends and I'll show you your future." We all realize that every relationship we have influences us. It either strengthens us or it weakens us. It pushes us to holiness. It pulls us away from that. Obviously, for most of us, the primary relationship is going to be with our spouse, and that's obviously going to have a huge impact. The Israelites were warned and commanded not to intermarry, and Trammell just had two great lessons on marriage last week, so I'll skip that part. But our friends, our co-workers, our classmates, they all have an influence on us. You know, and Paul realized that we could not avoid immoral people in the world. And if we flip to 1 Corinthians chapter 5, in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, in verse 9, Paul writes, "I wrote you in my letter not to associate with immoral people. I did not at all mean with the immoral people of the world, or with the covetous and swindlers, or with idolaters, for then you would have to go out of the world." He recognized there would be some engagement with immoral people. But the same man writing to the same church in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, in 2 Corinthians 6:14, he said, "Do not be bound together with unbelievers. For what partnership have righteousness and lawlessness? Or what fellowship has light with darkness? Or what harmony has Christ with Belial? Or what has a believer in common with an unbeliever? Or what agreement has the temple of God with idols? For we are the temple of the living God. Just as God said, 'I will dwell in them and walk among them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people.' Therefore, come out from their midst and be separate, says the Lord. Do not touch what is unclean, and I will welcome you. And I will be a father to you, and you shall be sons and daughters to me, says the Lord Almighty." We're called to be separate. We're called to be different. And are we in our relationships maintaining that separateness? Are we striving to cultivate relationships with people who will lead us to holiness and avoid relationships? Sorry, this thing's... Trammell fixed the cord. He messed everything up. Are we cultivating those relationships that will lead us to holiness? Or are we cultivating relationships that will pull us away from God, that will make us fit in with the world around us? Second thing I want to look at is work. You know, I think the most obvious question is, you know, what do we do? Is it a moral occupation? Is it a good influence on us? Does it allow us to attend services? I think there are some jobs that just aren't a good idea for Christians, whether they put you in a situation where you're exposed to temptation, where they put you in a situation where you can't attend services and work with your church family. But even if it's a good occupation, it's a moral occupation, who are your coworkers? Are they a positive influence or a negative influence? Sometimes you may need to leave a job because of the people you work with. And I want to look at the example of Lot in Genesis chapter 13. In Genesis chapter 13, we read the story of Lot, who was Abraham's nephew. And Abraham and Lot were both wealthy men with large herds and large estates. And they lived together, but then it started to cause trouble between their herds. and their herdsmen. In Genesis chapter 13, starting in verse 5, says, "Now Lot, who went with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents, and the land could not sustain them while dwelling together, for their possessions were so great that they were not able to remain together. And there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. Now the Canaanite and the Perizzite were dwelling then in the land. So Abram said to Lot, 'Please, let there be no strife between you and me, nor between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brothers. Is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me. If to the left, then I will go to the right, or if to the right, then I will go to the left.' And Lot lifted up his eyes and saw the valley of the Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt as you go to Zoar. So Lot chose for himself all the valley of the Jordan, and Lot journeyed eastward. Then they separated from each other. Abram settled in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled in the cities of the valley, and moved his tents as far as Sodom." You know, Lot made his decision based on economic concerns. Lot looked at the land and said, "That side's green, that side's a desert, I'm going there." In verse 13 it says, "Now the men of Sodom were wicked exceedingly and sinners against the Lord." Lot's decision cost him his family, it cost him all his possessions, and Peter says that his soul was tormented by the wicked conduct of those around him. Did Lot consider that? Do we consider that? You know, if you're looking to take a job, do you look at what church families are available where you're moving to? It's a big consideration. I had a job offer one time, or an interview that I was interviewing for, pretty much my dream job, with Cabela's, which is a great company. It's in the middle of western Nebraska, 3 hours from Denver. There are no churches anywhere around. I turned that down. That was a hard decision. But those are the kind of decisions that we have to make. We have to realize that we're called to more than just satisfying our physical, our needs and desires. Lastly, I want to look at entertainment. You know, just like our friends, the books we read, the movies we watch, the music we listen to, all of these things influence us. Are we letting things into our home through entertainment that we would never tolerate from our kids or ourselves or our spouse? You know, we have to remember that that which is tolerated will one day be accepted and will one day be celebrated. There's a progression there. And this is a hard thing. This is something I struggle with, because there's not a whole lot of, you know, clean, wholesome entertainment these days. But I've been reading recently the book called In His Steps, and I'm sure some of y'all have read that or are familiar with the premise at least. And the premise is that there's a church, and I think it was in Kansas in the early 1900s, and the minister one day said, I plan for the next year to do nothing and make no decisions without asking, what would Jesus do? And he said, if any of you want to participate, you're free to, you don't have to, but that's what we're going to commit ourselves to do for the next year. And of course, there were a lot of people, in a modern society, that's an unrealistic goal. How would we know what Jesus would do? How could we even apply that? They said, well, that's what we're going to try and do. And if we don't know, we're just going to try our best. And reading through the scenarios that the people find themselves in, all fairly realistic scenarios, it makes you think. And it makes you think, would Jesus watch that movie? Would Jesus listen to that song? And if the answer is no, why would you? Why would a people for God's own possession do something that Jesus, our prime example, would not? I don't know. We're called to be different. We're called to be something holy and something special. And I think that's something I'm going to have to think about after this lesson and move and figure out in my own life. So, it's kind of depressing, I guess. There's a lot to holiness. It's not easy. But here's the good news. This is not an arbitrary set of rules designed to make us miserable. It's not even a wise man's opinion of what's most likely a good idea. God, as our Creator, knows what's best for us. He knows what will lead us to ultimate peace and joy. Yes, we're called to be different. Yes, at times that will seem boring. Yes, at times that will seem unfair. Yes, at times it will cause us hurt or persecution. But we have to remember we are in this world. We are not of this world. We are made for an eternal home with God, with the holy and perfect God, and we will eventually, finally, be complete and holy in Him. In 2 Corinthians 4, Paul wrote, "Therefore we do not lose heart, but though our outer man is decaying, yet our inner man is being renewed day by day. For momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison. While we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal." We are promised final completion and perfection. We are promised holiness and an eternal home with God. The challenge of this life won't compare with the blessings of the next. But at the same time, when we think of God's holiness and that perfection versus where we're at, I think it can be intimidating. The good news is we can take it one step at a time, and we don't do this alone. I found a quote by C.S. Lewis. Hopefully you can read that, but I'll read as well. "Christ, who will in the long run be satisfied with nothing less than absolute perfection, will also be delighted with the first feeble stumbling effort you make tomorrow to do the simplest duty. Every father is pleased at the baby's first attempt to walk. No father would be satisfied with anything less than a firm, free, manly walk in a grown-up son. In the same way, God is easy to please, but hard to satisfy. God's demand for perfection need not discourage you in the least in your present attempts to be good, or even in your present failures. Each time you fall, He will pick you up again, and He knows perfectly well that your own efforts are never going to bring you anywhere near perfection. On the other hand, you must realize from the outset that the goal towards which He is beginning to guide you is absolute perfection, and no power in the whole universe, except you yourself, can prevent him from taking you to that goal. I think that many of us, when Christ has enabled us to overcome one or two sins that were an obvious nuisance, are inclined to feel, though we do not put it into words, that we are now good enough. As we say, I never expected to be a saint. I only wanted to be a decent, ordinary chap. And we imagine when we say this that we are being humble. But this is the fatal mistake." And he goes to the paragraph I didn't put up there. He talks about a baby and the stages they go through in the womb and how they might be satisfied at any one of them, but God has a plan that He takes them through. And he says, "But all the time He knew His plan for us and was determined to carry it out. Something the same is happening now at a higher level. To shrink back from that plan is not humility. It's laziness and cowardice. To submit to it is not conceit or megalomania. It is obedience. You thought you were going to be made into a decent little cottage, but He is building a palace. He intends to come and live in it Himself." Friends, we're called to perfection. We're called to holiness. We're called to being like God. And that's not something we can do on our own, and that's not something that we can do tomorrow. And the good news is we don't have to. God has a plan that He's working. You know, Philippians 2 says, "God works in you both to will and to work for His good pleasure." All we're called to is to submit. We're called to submit our will to His, to set ourselves apart as His people, and called to follow His plan. And we invite you in the first step in that plan is baptism. If you haven't joined yourself to God through baptism, we invite you to do that tonight. But if there's anything else we can do, we invite you to come as we stand and sing.